You're listening to THS, Tech House in Speed, making mind shatters move.
What's up? This is Tech House in Speed, NASCAR Free Radio. This week we're spending an hour with Gale Banks, revolutionary mind in the aftermarket hot rod industry, in turbocharging, supercharging, combining those two into one engine, and more times than not nowadays, that engine is a diesel engine, just like the brains are doing at Audi. Gale Banks Engineering, he's doing everything from building marine engines to engines for Bonneville to 14, 15, and 16-liter engines. That's over 1,000 cubic inches to put in a Freightliner truck and race it up the hill at Pikes Peak. You're going to learn so much from this, including how a man learns to think out of the box. Gale Banks, a big thinker. We start an hour with him right after this. This is a vertical look at the world of sports car racing, including drifting, time attack, and rallying. We'll be here every Wednesday night at 8 Eastern, 5 Pacific, on Race Fan Radio to have some fun advancing the knowledge of sports cars. You can contact me through my website at buybillwood.com. You'll find links to Twitter and Facebook at THS Talk, or email me at thstalk@mail.com. Gale Banks, Banks Engineering. I saw a sign on the wall said you started in 1958. That means you would have to be, what, two when you started?
Actually, I started booming with engines when I was 12. Sold my first engine, which was a Studebaker, hot-rodded Studebaker V8. Put it in a 33 Plymouth Coupe for a customer. That was my first sale, $1,100 in 1958, August of 58, I started my
wow.
business. Yeah,
1958. So tell me some of these stories. One that I saw in one of the articles that you rebuilt an engine in your mom's 32 Roadster or something?
Well, actually, it was a 31 Cabriolet.
Okay.
It was like a cloth top with Landau irons on it. It was a up-level Model A Ford. And a four-cylinder, 40-horsepower flathead. And she blew the head gasket, and my dad said, why don't you fix that for your mother? That was in 1954. So I started working on it, and I thought, why don't I hop this thing up while I'm at it? So I mowed a lot of lawns and pulled a lot of weeds and raked a lot of leaves, and earned the money to get a four-port Riley overhead valve conversion for it, and went to Ed Iskandarian for a camshaft, went to Jan's Piston Company for some high-compression pistons, and I used a Model B block, which gave me pressure oiling, and I used a Model C crank, which had counterweights on it, and I made it as modern as I could, but I didn't want to swap the engine out. I wanted a hot rod, old school hot rod, this thing. Put two Winfield carburetors on it, which they used on Indy engines at the time. And I got a magneto off of a farm tractor, a Wico magneto, and geared it off the front timing gear, and that was my ignition. Built my first header. Got it chromed.
So Banks Engineering was already in operation.
But I wasn't selling it. I was just hot rodding first my mother's car, and then it went from 40 to 105 horsepower. It was quite a increase in power.
What'd she say after she got in and she couldn't drive it like she used to?
Oh, she loved it. It was okay by her, but it blew the rear end. And I couldn't find the parts that I wanted, so she bought another car. We put it in the garage, and I got a 41 Chevy that I was hopping up with a GMC 270 engine, and that's a whole nother story. That was my next hot rod. My dad sold the car for what he paid for it, which was $35, and with all my speed equipment on it, when I found out, I said, did you collect for the speed equipment too? He says, no, I sold it for what I bought it for. You left it in the garage for months, you know. And that was the end of that argument.
$35, yeah. That's like a tank of gas. That's not even a tank of gas.
I know. But, I mean, he bought that car for $35.
Wow.
I bought my 41 Chevy for $75. You know, this is back in the 50s. And I hot-rodded that, and then I hot-rodded a 38 Buick, ran it down at Lyons Drag Strip. And finally, I've acquired a lot of parts. Studebaker had built an Indy V8 engine for Indianapolis in the early 50s with double overhead cam, four-valve heads. So I got the Agajanians actually financed that deal. I found some of the old used parts. So I built up this Studebaker-based Indy V8, and this guy who frequented my shop said, I got to own that engine and put it in my Plymouth. And he offered me the $1,100, and that was it, done deal. And that helped me finance buying some shop equipment, you know, boring bar and valve grinding equipment and other things I needed. That was my first capitalization of Banks Power.
Wow.
Yeah.
Banks Power, that's the company.
Yeah. The corporation is Gale Banks Engineering.
Okay. So Gale Banks Engineering is the umbrella.
It is.
For Banks Power. And how many other companies?
There's four other ones.
Okay.
Banks Racing, Banks Technologies. We do a lot of electronics design and consulting. A Banks Powertrain. I'm leaving one out. Oh, Banks Marine. Banks Marine. That's our marine engine business. So there's five under Gale Banks Engineering.
I saw Gale Banks. I saw there was, in the research, there was something about your dad telling you at one time that if you deal with 10 or 100.
Oh,
tell me about that.
He called that the rule of 10 and the rule of 100.
Yeah.
And he said, the rule of 10 goes like this. You make somebody, a customer, extremely happy with your service and your product, and he'll tell approximately 10 people. That's the rule of 10. The rule of 100 is, you screw around with a customer, you make them unhappy, you give them inferior product, they'll tell approximately 100 people. So the lesson here is, do it right. Because if you do it wrong, bad news travels fast.
Was your dad, he wasn't he was in the military or in the police or something.
Yeah. He was in the Army. There was no Air Force during World War II. That was part of the Army. They called it the Army Air Corps. And he ran an airport in Japan during the occupation. He went in the Army about a year and a half before the end of the war. He would have been in the invasion force for Japan, but they surrendered, and he was there running everything that was motorized on the airbase except for the airplanes. So he was not an aircraft mechanic. Mm-hmm. And a lot of guys learned a lot of good trades in World War II. I mean, and came out and started all the industry that we had after World War II. He was a perfectionist. Everything had to be absolutely perfect. That's why he gave me that little business lesson. And he wanted me to do the same thing. So he helped me build a lot of this stuff. You know, I'd be out working in the shop 2-3 in the morning, and suddenly he comes sliding under on a creeper and, you know, start wrenching stuff. I'd go, you know, by then he was an L.A. policeman after the war. And he went, well, you're keeping me up. I can hear you out here. I can't sleep. So I thought I'd come out and help you get done so I can sleep.
So you said your dad was a perfectionist. It must be in the bank's DNA, because you're kind of a perfectionist too. When we were doing a little tour, I could hear that it's not done till it's done perfectly.
It's a business problem if you're like that, because my dad, before he became a cop, he started a couple of his own businesses. And you can't charge for perfection. You got to do it really good. If you do it perfect, you go broke. So, and he did it twice. I didn't take a paycheck for the longest time after I got married, just to pound money back in the business. But I was running the business pure perfection, racing engines, things like that need to be perfect. But if you're building something commercial, if you're 20% better than everything on the market, that is perfect. I had to learn that. So we don't make absolutely perfect stuff, but we make absolutely excellent stuff, which is one step under perfect.
And everybody else is doing it very good and just cranking it out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Gale Banks, we're going to get into you building your business through the energy crisis. We're going to get into the future of racing, because it fascinates me that people are going to one day take diesel power and replace that with small block Fords and Chevys. Replace the small block
With diesel power.
With diesel power.
Yes.
And how'd you get into diesel? We're going to go into that.
That'll be big. Yes.
Right after this.
You're listening to Tech House and Speed.
Keep up with Tech House and Speed, NASCAR Free Radio. It's THS Talk on Facebook and Twitter. Programming is on demand at iTunes under Tech House and Speed and at buybillwood.com or techhouseandspeed.com on the web. On demand, on topic, on the point, on iTunes. Tech House and Speed, NASCAR Free Radio.
You're listening to THS, Tech House and Speed, making mind shatters move. Tech House and Speed will be right back. You're listening to THS.
Gale Banks, Banks Powertrain, Banks Power, Banks Engineering. Tell me again the umbrella.
The umbrella company is Gale Banks Engineering.
Gale Banks Engineering.
Yeah.
All right. In some of the research I saw, because I remember this, when in the early 70s, I remember I had, this is a story on myself.
Yes.
I had a 67 GTO, one of the great
How
cars
cool
I
is
ever
that?
Had. One of the I bought it from a guy. It was a great decision that I made once. He thought the engine was blown, but it turned out all it needed was an intake manifold gasket. And I went back and put about $70 into it, put new gaskets, rebuilt the carburetor, and it was a Texas car, so it didn't have all the California smog on it.
Right.
Man, that thing ran like a scalded ape. No rust.
Yeah.
I loved that car. But then the gas crisis hit. This was like 74.
Yeah.
And after waiting in line like four times, I stupidly panicked and sold it. You looked at the other side of that coin and said, there's a business opportunity here. What told Gale Banks that there's a business opportunity here versus get rid of this and go do something else?
Well, the gas crunch caused a recession as well.
Yeah.
But from 58 to 73, 74, we had some other slow business periods. And I think I've been through seven of them now, counting the one we're coming out of right now. Every recession has the kernels of opportunity in it. In other words, if you run your business with blinders on, then you're going to run out of business to do. Markets change, demands change. In 73. That fuel crunch was horrendous. We all of us old enough to be driving then remember it vividly. So I had a sheet metal business building 18-quart oil pans for my marine engines. And I sold my marine engines, twin-turbo Gale Banks marine engines, worldwide. We were, for decades, the power option in the marine industry worldwide. The engines were big block Chevys, twin turboed and intercooled, and they made a 850 horsepower, the pleasure versions, and the offshore racing versions made mid nines, 930 to 950 horsepower. That business slowed down tremendously with that fuel crunch. I had this sheet metal capability. They built pickup trucks at the time with 16, 18-gallon gas tanks. They didn't have a lot of capacity. And there were contractors and others who would fill up every day. Well, you couldn't get gas till every other day. They did that last number of your license plate, even.
Right, it's odd,
odd
even
one
days.
Day.
Yeah,
the right. Next day was even. The next day was odd.
Yeah.
Well, if a guy lived, say, in Monrovia, and he was working out in the desert or something like that, he's buying gas all the time. So we went into the auxiliary fuel tank business with that sheet metal capability that I had, got all our stuff Department of Energy certified, or whatever the department was at that time, and we ran that sheet metal gas tank business for like a couple of years, 7 days a week. We couldn't make enough of them. Finally, industry, the automotive, they came out with saddle tanks where they had two gas tanks on a vehicle. Or they enlarged the single tank. I remember having a Suburban that had a 36-gallon fuel tank in it. You know, stuff like that. So there was an opportunity. The guys with motorhomes and pickup trucks that towed big campers on them, or trailers and campers, or a Jeep behind them, they wanted fuel economy as well. So we designed a whole package of components to improve the torque peak of the engine. That's where they're most economical, most efficient. We tuned headers for the torque peak. And we still make them for V10 Ford motorhomes. The primary tubes are like 5 feet long to tune down into the torque peak rather than high up racing headers, which are shorter, tuned for the horsepower peak. So I came out with what we have a U.S. trademark, Banks Power Pack. And it's cold air intake, like ram air intake. At the time, it was a different ignition system, a high energy ignition system, and our tuned exhaust system, and it gave them quite a kick in the tail in terms of fuel economy and performance. So that was an opportunity born by the first.
Let's stop
fuel
a minute
crunch.
Here. Where did Gale Banks learn to look at a crisis and see the opportunity instead of the problem?
My mother.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about? Is that the same woman
my mother was
who let you hot rod her convertible
Ford? Yeah, well, I don't know if she let me, but I did it. I was hot wiring that thing when she was away, you know, when I was like 10 years old. Anyhow, to those not old enough to know about hot wiring, that was just jumpering around the ignition switch to get it started without a key.
Yeah.
She was the business person in my family. She invested in property. She was the thinker, so to speak. And not that my dad wasn't a thinker, but his business was making perfection. Her business was trying to make money. And
finding where the perfection would work.
Yeah, and finding where the market is. You know, if you're making buggy whips and there's no more horses and all you know how to do is make buggy whips, you're done.
Yeah.
That's a direct quote from my mother.
Wow.
You gotta broaden your horizon, broaden your point of view to everything that fits your skill set. If you've got a given set of skills, and the market for those skills dries up, you got to look at where else you can leverage those skills. And that's what I've done through seven recessions.
All right. So you started off with gasoline.
Yes.
Small block motors.
Yes.
Standard small block Chevys.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Ford, lots of them.
The standard thing.
Yeah.
Where did diesel come in? That's kind of what you're known for now is diesel.
Yeah, but I'm still known for turbocharging. Turbocharging was my deal originally.
Yeah.
There were guys known for camshafts, Ed Iskandarian, Jack Engel, those guys. There were guys known for fuel injection. Stuart Hilborn would be one of them. And it got to where...
These are guys that you all grew up with.
They're friends of mine.
In Southern California.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You guys built the hot rod.
And Iske and Hilborn are still with us. The bottom line, though, was that I'd look at this and I'd go, most guys don't call injectors. They call them Hilborns. It's like Kleenex.
Yeah.
You know, and
or
I...
Or Xerox or Frigidaire. Yeah.
Yeah. And I went, you know, I want people to say banks when they think about turbocharging. So I got into it. We were a very early adopter. There were a couple of Ohls F85. There was a Corvair Spider with a turbo, which went out of production, I think, 67. And then there were no turbocharged vehicles at all being built in Detroit for quite a few years. So... The guy who was chief engineer on the turbo program at TRW, who supplied the Corvair project, Hugh McInnes, I called him up and I said, I'm interested in turbocharging. I'd like to come and meet with you. We became such good friends. He was like an uncle to me. And he sucked me into programs that he was doing. I was doing an awful lot of very high-performance marine turbocharging at the time. So he was going to do this book on turbocharging, which HP Books published, and it's still published. And he asked for one of my engines on the cover. Since then, till today, that all the editions of that book have a Banks engine on the cover. It's now a twin-turbo road race engine, Chevy-based. But the point being that I wanted to be infamous when it came to turbocharging.
Well, all you guys did in that time frame when you were building.
Yeah, there were guys playing with turbochargers as well, but I made them production. They were on my engines. I sold engines. The marine engines were turbocharged from the late 60s on. I have probably applied in excess of 100,000 turbochargers to engines. Whether we were doing 15,000 to 20,000 a year for a few years before the factory started turbocharging the diesel pickups. What got me into diesel, though, was I was approached by a couple of guys, physicists that I knew at Caltech. Richard Feynman was one of them, and another one is still around. He came to my place with Richard from time to time. His name is Murray Gell-Mann. Both of these guys are Nobel laureates, sharp cookies. Feynman had this kind of car project.
Garage hot rod guys.
Hey.
These are Nobel laureates.
They are.
Wow.
I remember... I was working on a hydrogen-powered Chevy. This is mid-70s. That was part of a study called Should We Have a New Engine, funded with a $400,000 grant from the Ford Foundation. Caltech won that grant. This was in reaction to the first fuel crunch. Caltech won the grant. They vended it out to their jet propulsion laboratory. And we became a facilitator for JPL on the project. This is the report of all of that effort. In the effort, every engine that existed in the world was fair game. Had to be a running engine, though. No paper studies. So Stirlings, Braytons, steam, gas turbines, gasoline, existing engine technology, and also diesel. They were all considered. We ended up, diesel came in number three, and I went, there's something to this.
Out of all the technology out there,
that was the one that showed the future, because it was so fuel efficient and built just like a normal engine. So we had the infrastructure to build them. Today, all these other magical engines aren't being built by anybody.
The rotary, for example, even Mazda's dropped it for whatever reason.
I know. From where we dig the iron ore out of the ground and pour the block casting, our industry in the United States has set up to build internal combustion reciprocating engines, period. We're studying other stuff. Nobody has blinders on, but I'm a futurist. And this was a study of the future. This published document is so full of very accurate considerations, economical, projecting into the future, fuel, all of, you know, would the elements be available for the next 50 years? That was the premise of this. And the elements that were available, could they be configured to these idea engines? And I disagreed with the results of the study. I centered on diesel. Wow. I wanted to know more about diesel.
Gale Banks Engineering, Gale Banks, or Banks Power, Banks Powertrain. We could talk for years, but we got to keep moving here. Let's go into a number of secondary things that you're doing that have taken over the back shop there. Military, your Freightliner, the Pikes Peak effort.
Yes.
You've got records set at Bonneville. Gale Banks, we're going to go all over that in the next segment. We'll be right back.
You're listening to THS.
Watch with us on iTunes, Tech House and Speed, NASCAR Free Radio.
THS. We'll be right back. You're listening to Tech House and Speed.
Gale Banks Engineering, thank you. This is fascinating to me, this time.
I'm enjoying it, too.
The tour that you gave me in the back.
Yes.
You told me a lot of stuff about the military, and some of the stuff we can't talk about here. But I'm still fascinated. You told me how you got the diesel, which kind of blows my mind because it's one of those things that just happens.
Yeah.
Like, what did they say? Jupiter aligned with Mars.
Yeah, that's rare. But
it all came together.
Yeah.
And the diesel, I guess your reputation preceded you, and the military came to you maybe and said, how could you improve what we're doing and our diesel capacity?
Well, what really happened was I started offering marine engines for commercial use. I had a lot of sport fishing boats using them and commercial fishermen, and so I built a very rugged 535-horse twin-turbo engine that would run on 84-octane. I mean, really bad gas. You could send it anywhere in the world, and it would do its thing. The Navy bought a
500-plus horsepower on regular.
Yeah, it was actually lower than regular.
Wow.
At the time, premium was like 102 octane. You know, regular was probably 87 or 88
something
or 90.
That you could probably only do in a diesel, and
But in this case, it was gasoline.
Ah, okay.
This is 1975.
Okay.
We had done this work with JPL, or were in it at the time, and but I'm already building these engines. And had been building them for a number of years. So I built this 535-horse engine, and the Navy bought some of them from me. And that started my military business right there, 1975. I have no idea where the engines were used. I met a retired Navy guy the other day who told me he thought that he knew where those engines were applied. And I asked him, can you tell me? And he says, and I was told not to, and I'm taking it to my grave. But it might have been someplace like Grenada. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm guessing.
Yeah.
But that started the military business. And you know, we were going into diesel. 1978, GM and Detroit Diesel did a new V8 engine, a 6.2 liter for the Chevy and GMC pickups, coming out in 82. But they started the program back in 78. They shipped me a couple of the prototype engines and said, can you twin turbo these and make marine engines out of them? Would you be interested in doing that? I went, okay, here I am. I'm doing diesel. And we did do the turbo program on them, and they would not sustain it. You got to have an engine that's a candidate for that kind of stuff, and this wasn't it. But then they came out in the pickup trucks late 81, and Pontiac was asking me to run a 82 Firebird at Bonneville. I had the car. A lot of the Pontiac dealers sold GMC trucks, so GMC sent me two trucks for support vehicles, and they both had this new diesel and no turbo. So we took one of our prototype Firebirds to the SEMA show, going over Cajon Pass. It was so slow going up the pass. By the time we got to the giant thermometer at the top there, Baker, I had to shave. I mean, it was just, it had been a while. So I just kind of, I said to the guys, when we get back to L.A., we're turboing these things. So Bob Robe, who's still with me, he's been here 30-some years, closer to 40 years. I says, let's come in Saturdays. I'll make the parts. You make the drawings. So we started cobbling it up, and we came out with a turbo system, and that was the beginning of the diesel power aftermarket. That was the first product in the market was our turbo setup, our Sidewinder turbo for the 6.2 liter GM engines.
I remember that brand thing, yeah, Sidewinder.
And we, in 83, Ford came out with theirs. We did a Sidewinder for that. So, and then in like 87, John Rock was running GMC and also had the responsibility for the diesel engines for their pickup trucks and Chevys. And he calls me one day and he says, hey, we had the truck show here at Anaheim at the time. It's now at Vegas, this big international truck show. He says, I'm coming out for the truck show. Can you go to breakfast with me? I said, what day? And we set up the date, had breakfast with him. And he said, our diesel engine production is hurting because Ford is a hell of a competitor and we have nothing new. And he says, you've been turboing our engines for like 4 years now, and we don't see you in our warranty numbers. In other words, you're not failing our engines with your turbo. Mm. And I said, that's because I tested that. You know, I found the weak spots and tuned back from that. It gave me about a 20% safety margin. So they're durable.
Your 10-100 perfection.
Well, yeah. So we kicked up the perfection. And so he says, how about we make it a dealer-specified option for GMC trucks, and you do the marketing. I'll warrant the truck. You warrant the turbo system, and we'll go to market together and hopefully get some press to put a little life in our diesel engine program. So we did it, and we set up a little plant in Elmont, Michigan, you know, with a family known as the Rinkies. They're very big in automotive in Detroit. And Jim and Dennis Rinke, they were involved in this. And They'd ship the vehicles from Flint Assembly over to us. We'd apply the turbocharging. They'd ship it back to Flint and out to the dealers. So we did that. We, therefore, the first dealer available, you know, turbo diesel pickups were Banks turbocharged. We beat the Dodge Cummins by like 2 years.
And then how did you cross over into the military application? Because the military's come into, you got 10 engines out there now that are being shipped to the military.
Yeah. We supply V6 and V8 diesel engines, Banks diesel engines, to the military and ultimately to the general public and industrial uses as well. Our V8's based on the Duramax, and we have worldwide rights to sell that engine in various forms, up to us. And it is, in my estimation, the best of the diesel engines out there right now. And, of course, we do things to make it even better. The V6, we have an exclusive arrangement with VM Motori in Italy. They manufacture the base engine, and it's a part number that we buy. We have exclusive in North America on that engine. So we're doing the diesel thing. The diesel aftermarket, of course, we essentially started it. Now there's hundreds of people in it.
Yeah.
It became a SEMA, a huge SEMA thing. So
Gale Banks Engineering. This past year, you went up the hill at Pikes Peak.
Yes.
In this big freight liner.
Yes.
Mike Ryan is the driver. He did all this changeover in his truck.
Exactly.
Still out there in the shop.
Yes.
Came within just seconds of a record, even running in the rain. You made a huge number of changes.
Yes.
You like almost started from a clean sheet of paper and rebuilt this thing. If the technology that's in there, is that going to be the future for diesel, for big freight liners, for semis? Tell me about that project and how it matters to me.
Okay. Well, there's two elements there. The first one is I built a pair of prototype engines for military use, boat engines. And I wanted to get the boats on plane quicker, up on top and going. So I put a supercharger to blow them out of the hole and up on top of the water.
To deal with the bottom end.
Yeah, and two turbochargers to carry the mid-range and the top end. I kind of take the supercharger out of the airflow scheme for middle and top end. It worked beautifully. We tested in a large boat and did everything I wanted to do. So I was at, it's about 3-4 years ago, one of my customers asked for better power at high altitude for their military vehicles, and I went, how high is the altitude? And they said, well, the highest might be around 14,000 feet. And I went, okay, where can I test at 14,000 feet? Well, the only place with a road to the top of it is Pikes Peak. That's the highest road in the United States. So I kind of went, all right, I got to find a connection with Pikes Peak. And within a month, a customer of ours, Leonard Arnold, who lives in Colorado Springs, calls me. We talk about it. He and Paul Dollenbach were running an unlimited open-wheel mid-engine car, you know, with a transaxle, pure race car on Pikes Peak. It had a SB1 NASCAR engine in it, fuel-injected and running on methanol, making about 680 horsepower. But it lost power. The higher you get, the more power you lose.
It fell off, yeah.
And I'm going, I need to develop some turbocharging for one of my defense customers. What better way to do it than on Paul Dollenbach's car. So we twin-turboed the engine, dropped the compression ratio, twin-turboed the engine, got it up to 1,307 horsepower, and we proceeded to break everything else in the car. You know, we kind of overwhelmed the powertrain. So, but the car ran world record speeds in practice. Then he twisted off a half shaft at the start of the race. So we didn't get a time, but we knew where we were. But I got my turbo control information for use on the military side of things. So I went to Pikes Peak to help out Leonard Arnold and Paul Dollenbach, because they're both fine gentlemen. And we had a great time, and I got my knowledge for Afghanistan. And that's pretty cool.
Amazing.
Yeah, that got me to Pikes Peak.
Yeah.
And
so that, wow.
Now, some guys might have seen this a year ago. We got it up to 1,400 horsepower, and Paul had a off-road excursion at about 140.
Yeah.
So that was unfortunate, but Paul was fine. And I met, the second time we ran with Paul Dollenbach, I met Mike Ryan. Now, I had known of Mike. I'd met him peripherally. We knew of each other for a long time. He's a Hollywood stuntman. He's a legend.
Yeah.
Stunt coordinator and stunt driver. I mean, the guy's amazing. And he was running his semi up there, and it was blowing black smoke. It had a compound turbo system, two turbos, one blowing into the next one and then into the engine. Not enough oxygen when you hit the pedal, so you just blow smoke. You see tractor pullers do that. But that's horsepower you can see but not feel. That's fuel you put in the engine and made little tiny briquettes out of it. You know, it's just, and there, all that energy is in the air. To me, that's a waste. It's also the negative legacy of diesel. Smoke should be gone. It is gone on any modern diesel. He's sponsored by Freightliner and Detroit Diesel. That's not good for them either. So I got into the deal with him. I said, I want to do a super turbo. I can make your truck cease to smoke, make it more powerful, and it'll come off the turns a lot harder. We did it, four-month project. We added our straight-shot water methanol injection system. So we took it. His engine was originally 825 horsepower. We took it, and a marine engine, by the way, in the semi-tractor, but that's the highest stock output for a Detroit diesel 14-liter. And we're now at 2,400 horsepower, and when we turn on the straight shot injection, we're at 2,800 horsepower. The thing is a rocket ship. The smoke is minimized, almost gone. We need more tuning time. We started the engine 8 days before Pikes Peak, and that gave us 6 days, because 2 days was just getting it there. So we had six development days. Three of those were practicing on the mountain, getting a couple of laps, but not near enough time to refine it. But it was running sub-record speeds in practice. We knew we had it covered, but Mother Nature didn't comply with our wishes.
It rained when you competition day, when it came time for you to go up the hill, it rained.
It rained in the pits. I mean, stormed. And then we get a little window of sunshine, and then it stormed again. They red flagged the race repeatedly. They were bringing cars off the mountain, watered in a ball. You know, I knew it was really dangerous. And but Mike suits up and sits in the truck in the pits. You know, I'm going over, I'm talking to him. Finally, they called up some cars. It was still wet at the top, snow melting and gravel running across the course. About 4 miles in, it was just wet. He left with a vengeance off the line after I told him, I don't care about the record. just get the truck to the top.
Yeah.
He tried for the record anyway.
But he's a driver. You can't tell a driver anything.
He tried for it anyway.
Even though you're a driver.
I'm telling you. I'm telling you, this is the most dangerous racing event I've ever encountered anywhere. That includes Baja. It includes anything. This is straight out dangerous. And you have to be a daredevil. I'm just, to go at the speed that he runs that, or the speed Dallenbach runs his, it's dangerous. And anyhow, the record is 12 minutes and 39 seconds for that truck. It's 12.42 miles. You gain a mile in altitude in 12 miles. The grade is huge. 156 turns in 12 miles. Probably 40% of them are hairpins, switchbacks. He made it in 12:49 in the wet, in the gravel, in the crap, through fog, you know, mountain clouds. He came within 10 seconds of breaking his record. It had that much more straightaway speed. The turns were horrendously bad.
All right, Gil Banks, we got one more segment to go, and this is the one that I'm really interested in. Will we ever see diesel replacing small block Fords and Chevys? The hot rodder mecca, that's where they go to do their deal. We're going to talk about that in the next segment right after this.
You're listening to Tech House and Speed.
THS Talk. Follow me on Twitter, like me on Facebook. Tech House and Speed. NASCAR Free Radio.
THS. We'll be right back. You're listening to Tech House and Speed.
We've been spending an hour with Gail Banks, Banks Engineering, Banks Powertrain, Banks Marine, and I'll call it Banks Brilliance. I've learned so much just walking around the shop and here spending this time with you. And what I'm learning is that Banks Turbocharging, which you're known for globally, and I'm putting diesel with that because you're getting more power out of diesel than anybody. You're running them at 6,500 RPM.
Yes.
That's unheard of. some small blocks don't twist that fast. So are we ever going to see diesel? We're slowly getting it out of our minds that diesel is just black smoke. Are we ever going to see diesel replacing the small block Fords and Chevys and Dodges, the Chryslers, the core of American hot rodding? Are you going to be the one to lead us into the new ground with that?
I'd like to be one of the guys. Yeah, I don't know about the one, but I can dream of that. The bottom line is, in the 80s, Buick scrapped their V8 and started making nothing but V6s. I helped them a lot with turbocharging those things, and we built prototype, which became the Buick Grand National in 1981. It was a twin-turbo engine, 454-horse, 3.8-liter gasoline burner. And it was in full page in Hot Rod Magazine sometime in 81. Darrell Waltrip's Regal with Junior Johnson and my Banks-powered twin-turbo Regal concept car. So, and one of my engines, I was standing behind one of the Buick V6 engines. That was an overreaction, you know, to the second fuel crunch. In kind of the dark ages of automotive performance, to be truthful about it. But we rebounded, fuel costs came down. We stabilized the oil market worldwide, and big-inch V8s were still the way to go. The turbos are expensive. Now, today, with fuel economy constraints, you're going to see V8s go away. Mm-hmm. I'm smaller, highly turbocharged in engines, and Ford is leading the charge. They're the most visible with their EcoBoost V6 twin turbo. in their EcoBoost four-cylinder single turbo. And they're even working on an experiment with engines all the way down to one-cylinder turbocharged. So,
really?
Yeah. I preached this gospel at General Motors Institute. I taught engine design for turbocharging and how to properly match the turbo to the work you wanted to do, how to design the engines so it was durable with a turbocharger. And some of those guys that were in my lectures or my seminars back there are still in the business. One of them at Ford Motor Company. So he's sending me these dyno charts a few years ago going, hey, look at this. Better than Buick, right? And I'm going, hey, what took you so damn long? You know, it's almost 30 years since I was preaching that gospel. And my gospel was a small 1 to 2 liter engine that has the frictional and viscous and parasitic losses of a little tiny engine is enough to push you at freeway speeds. When you want to climb a hill or accelerate hard, you push on the pedal, the turbocharger answers, and suddenly your little engine gets real big. So you look at their little 3.5 liter V6, it's 365 horsepower in a pickup truck. And they're going for a lot more with that thing, and it will produce a lot more. And there's going to be banks equipment for every turbocharged small engine that's popular and sold in the United States.
And these are gas engines.
These are gas engines. Now, you asked about diesel. Yeah, diesel's coming on. The little V6 that we're selling, a version of it will now be in the Grand Cherokee, the Ram 1500 for 2014, and you're going to see other Chrysler products using that V6 diesel as well, the 3-liter. I'm putting them in industrial and marine and military. I've got that side of the ball, or that, you know, that part of the game. That I want to put one of those things in my little Jeep, my LJ, my 2006 LJ. Perfect engine for that. There's going to be a lot more diesel available in the United States. You've got the Chevy Cruze coming with its diesel engine now. There's going to be a lot of it. Will it replace a small block Chevy? Nothing. Or small block Ford or mod motors or any of that stuff? Nah, it's not going to replace them. They might cease to make new ones. I see high specific output lightweight gasoline and diesel engines in the future. And I see hot rods that are hybrids. I tested the hybrid 7 BMW. I don't know if you saw any of those cars. They had them here in the United States. And I did an evaluation and a write-up for BMW on that. I also tested their hydrogen 7 at high altitude. But their hybrid 7, twin-turbo, 4-liter gasoline engine, and then where the flywheel would be, you've got a motor generator. So it generates and charges batteries in the trunk. And when you want performance, you put the pedal to the metal, it kicks in the electric motor and the gas engine. The thing's near 500 horsepower, and it's a rocket ship, and the damn thing got 26 miles to the gallon. You look at that, you go, what have you got out there in a full-size luxury car that performs like that and gets 26 miles to the gallon?
Now, we talked a little while ago. I'm cutting you off here because I wanted – we talked a little while ago about a company somewhere, Colorado maybe, that was building 1,000 horsepower diesels at 100 miles per gallon. And you kind of smiled and said you could have one or the other, but you can't have both.
That's true.
Is it exaggeration for a magazine article, or is there new ground? Is it possible to get to that side of the fence?
Yeah, I'm doing a semi-truck program where I'm fitting one of my 7-liter marine engines into a semi-tractor where there's a 15-liter engine currently. The whole idea here is...
15 liters.
Oh, yeah. Some of them are 16 liters. So I'm taking out a 3,000-pound engine. I'm putting in a 1,000-pound engine. I'm matching the engine to the existing transmission with a gearbox of my own. But I'm turning twice the RPM of the standard old technology engine. What happens is that same thing with the modern automobiles is a small engine, gas or diesel, highly turbocharged, and capable of making big numbers when you want it. If you look at line haul trucks, they're on flat land. Most of them are on flat land all the time. Some climb the Rockies, some are in the mountains, but it's not all the time. Even in the mountains, you have level ground here and there. Point is, I've got an extremely durable marine engine that makes over 800 horsepower, 7-liter diesel. I detune that to say 600 horsepower. Most of the time when you're cruising flat land, you're only using a couple of hundred horsepower. Most of the guys are going 55 miles an hour now. It doesn't take a hell of a lot to make you realize you've got this huge engine in there for the mountains, and most of the time it's wasting fuel running throttled. Big friction, big pumping losses, all the parasitics are big with a big engine. I'm cutting the engine size in half and using high speed when I need it. And I argue I can substantially increase the fuel economy through this effort.
But 1,000 horsepower and 100 miles per gallon is not going to happen.
That's if I could turn lead into gold, I could do that too. But I can't turn lead into gold.
So what about... if I'm thinking in terms of crate engines,
yes,
and I want to go to one of the manufacturers and get a crate engine, plug it into my Camaro, Mustang,
sure,
Challenger, whatever, I could think in terms of diesel now and not just gasoline. The top end might be better with diesel than it is with gasoline?
Well,
not top end in terms of speed, but the future might be better with diesel versus gasoline.
Diesel is inherently more reliable and lasts longer. Those engines are very rugged. Even mine, lightweight ones, high-speed ones, are very rugged. I am actually working on two projects. Both of them are 427s. I've got a 427 diesel. I'm looking for 2,000 horsepower, streetable. I've got a 427 I'm doing in a 68 Camaro with my son Andrew. I'm looking for 2,000 horsepower there. And the keys to that kingdom is our new straight-shot injection technology, our water meth. I first used it on Mike Ryan's truck on Pikes Peak, and I'm telling you, you can really work some magic with that stuff and a proper control system for it. So diesel is rising up to produce the horsepower numbers of gasoline. That's what's happening, and we're part of that. We're spinning the hell out of them so they'll make bigger power numbers.
And then you don't, with diesel, you don't have to worry about 102 octane.
No, because there is no octane problem with diesel. They run on detonation.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. Temperature ignites the fuel. Detonation is temperature igniting the fuel
so
in
it's
a gasoline
engine. So it's
going
to have to take a rethink when you think of hot riding.
Yes.
You think of high compression, big cams, stuff as much air in as you can, and lay it out on the ground.
Yes.
With diesel, it's a rethink, but you can still lay it out on the ground, but you're coming from another side of the tracks.
And I've got to tell you, my road race car, my Pro Stock S10, my back motor dragster, they all sound like a big block Chevy. I've had the dragster to 6,300 RPM. You ought to hear it. And I've done a blown motor with Zoomies.
And we're talking diesel here.
I know.
With stuff that spins normally at 3,000,
exactly.
3,500.
Exactly.
You're spinning it at 6,500.
Exactly. Yep.
Wow. And that you've figured out how to do that with engine management and making sure that detonation happens at the right place.
Or ignition in this case,
Ignition happens at the right place so that you can make power just like you can with the gasoline, only with diesel that makes it low octane and better, and you can go to Outback in Oklahoma or Utah or
anywhere. You can buy it at any truck stop.
Yeah.
You don't have to buy racing gas for a diesel. So the bottom line is I'm using gasoline airflow technology on diesel engines. I'm spinning the diesel engines as fast as the gasoline engines. And the diesel fuel has no octane problem because they run, frankly, on detonation. That's how they ignite. Bottom line is I'm blurring the distinction between the two. So you're going to have guys out of the Midwest who want a hot rod with a diesel in it. They're farm guys. They love that stuff. You're going to have guys on the coasts who want a turbo gasoline setup. What we're doing is pushing both fuel technologies. We're also looking at methanol made from natural gas. We're looking at compressed or liquefied natural gas as well. The methanol we ran in Dahlenbach's car on Pikes Peak was made from natural gas.
Wow.
Yeah, how about that? So I'm...
Neil Banks.
Just give me something that will burn and we'll do something with it. Something that will explode. Better stated.
Wow. Gail Banks Engineering. We could talk for another hour. You've got to get your day back to you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You can see where we see Audi and their diesel R18s. And you said,
beautiful stuff.
That's just high-end factory black.
It is, but they're turning close to 6,000 RPM as well. So, the diesel engines own it. You know, most prestigious race on the planet.
So it's Audi in Germany,
and
Gail Banks, a hot rider in Southern California, are both going
the same direction. Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thanks, partner. It's really good to talk to you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Tech House and Speed.
There you have it. If you've been a regular listener to Tech House and Speed, you know that I love to talk to the smart guys, and Gail Banks is one of the smart guys. He was around at the beginning of the hot rod aftermarket industry, and now he's going in another direction altogether, taking the hot rod aftermarket industry into another place with turbocharging and diesel. Curiously enough, we've mentioned it there at the end, Audi factory in Germany is doing the same thing with diesel, getting a lot out of it. Peugeot did the same thing, getting a lot out of diesel, spinning at high RPMs and winning the prestigious races in the world, especially at Le Mans. Is diesel the future? I don't know. Is it going to replace gasoline? I don't know. But it certainly has the option, and that's what we're looking for, options, alternatives. And it's going to be more affordable for people to consider diesel as an option instead of race gas, 13-14 to 1 compression, and the kind of thing that you need to open a big gate, stuff a lot of gas in there, slam the gate shut, and explode it as quickly as you can and get rid of all that residue and smog up the air. I don't know about you, but somehow in this performance world, there has to be an answer to smog, and it can't be pollution in the air is the answer to performance that we love to see out of race cars. Gail Banks, you spent an hour with him. You learned a little bit about him, where he got his intelligence from, where he learned to ask the questions from his mom and his dad. And he's been asking the questions all of his life and getting some answers that are surprising everybody because he refuses just to say, that's the way it's done and that's the way I'm going to do it, into the horizon. Gail Banks, Gail Banks Engineering, a Southern California hot rodder who's changing the hot rod aftermarket business now.
That's our show for this week. If you missed any of it, you can find it at iTunes, at buybillwood.com, at techhouseandspeed.com, or at racefanradio.com. You could also hear the show. It'll be running on our website at buybillwood.com. They're streaming constantly. If you want to hear anything again, you could go to our media page and hear those interviews on demand. Also want to remind you of our television show, The Racing Insiders, on MAV TV and DirecTV 219. You can find it Thursday, tomorrow at 2 o'clock Eastern and at 5 o'clock Eastern, and a replay on Saturdays at 12:30 Eastern. This week we've got a discussion about the Grand Am new rules package, about the race at Indy last weekend. We've got some interviews, especially with Brian Sellers, who's won the last two Continental Tire Sports Car Challenge races. That's on the Racing Insiders, 2 o'clock, 5 o'clock Eastern tomorrow, and at 12:30 Eastern on Saturday. This weekend, the Global Rallycross is going to be at X Games Los Angeles at Irwindale Speedway. Also, we'll have the Gymkhana Grid on Saturday at Irwindale. At something new with X Games. It's being debuted at X Games this year. Ken Block introduced it at Irwindale several years ago. They're bringing it back now. It's very big globally. I think Ken has maybe 10 events that he runs around the world. He'd certainly like to make it popular here in the United States, where he's from, obviously. And we'll be able to see some of that Gymkhana Grid Saturday X Games here in Los Angeles at Irwindale Speedway. The next round of Global Rallycross, the last X Games round, will be at Irwindale on Sunday. We'll have coverage of that here on Tech House and Speed and on the Racing Insiders. Next week, as also, we'll have some interviews next week as we get ready for the next ALMS round. That's at Road America the following weekend. In addition to X Games this weekend, we've got Rally Finland, the Pirelli World Challenge at Mid-Ohio, and DTM is at Moscow. We'll have coverage of that next week on Tech House and Speed. Look forward to seeing you next week, 8 o'clock Eastern, Race Fan Radio. Until then, take care of each other, respect each other. I'm Bill Wood. Peace. THS Talk. Follow me on Twitter, like me on Facebook. Tech House and Speed, NASCAR Free Radio.
You're listening to THS, Tech House and Speed, making mind shatters move. You're listening to Tech House and Speed.